Welcome to Parents' Perspective. You're doing what? Berna's friend Kim nearly shrieked at her, putting her cup of coffee down with a clunk. Yes, I'm joining up. I'm sure I must have told you, Berna replied. No, I certainly would have remembered, Kim responded emphatically. But why? Well, Berna began, staring into her half-empty mug, I thought being in the service would be a good change for me. A good change? Kim looked at her friend as though she'd lost her senses. What kind of change did you want? You could get shot or blown up. Calm down, Berna tried to reassure her. There are all kinds of opportunities. I might also get trained for something really interesting. And of course I'll get to travel, she smiled. You'll be traveling with a gun by your side, Kim reminded her. Although with all those guys around, maybe you'll need one, she laughed. Well, I'll be too busy cleaning our bunks for any funny stuff, Berna giggled. From a parent's perspective, what should we know about life for young women in the military? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest today can speak with some authority on this issue about women in the military. Mary Beth Brueggemann graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy in May of 1999 and received a commission as a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps. She deployed to Kuwait in January of 2003, moved forward to Iraq during the war, and then redeployed from Kuwait in May 2003. Currently, she's a company officer at the Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, and is married to Major Brian Brueggemann, USMC. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Captain Brueggemann.
Thank you for having me here.
Why did you join the military?
I have a great uncle who I'm very close to, who graduated from the Naval Academy in 1945. And he took me to a Navy Air Force game when I was in sixth grade, and I was hooked. And that was all it took. And I decided that was really something I wanted to be a part of. That was right before the first Gulf War, right before Desert Storm. And I watched all the coverage, and it was very interesting.
What kinds of preconceptions of this military life did you have before you were actually in?
Well, most of my preconceptions have turned out to be correct. I expected to be joining an organization that was very strong bonds between individuals, what we considered to be a sort of an elite group of folks who were very driven and very dedicated and wanted to serve their country and wanted to do something bigger than themselves. And that's what I've found.
How about day-to-day life? What is that like for you? It's obviously quite different than being a civilian.
Right. Well, actually, right now, there's probably some striking similarities. I sit behind a desk a lot of the time, as little as possible. But as a company officer, I'm a manager of people now. I have about 140 midshipmen at the Naval Academy. And while they're in class, I'm dealing with little issues on the side and making sure that they are developed. You know, our mission is to develop the midshipmen morally, mentally, and physically. So I'm sort of off in the side making sure that that's happening and they're getting everything they need out of the Naval Academy and becoming combat leaders, which is our goal.
How did all of this differ when you served in a foreign country?
At first, when we were in Kuwait, it was very busy. That was before the war started. It was getting ready and planning and training the Marines and making sure they were ready for anything that happened because, as we've seen, things happen that you don't expect every day over there. So it was just making sure that we could keep them safe and they knew how to do their jobs and we could support the people we needed to support. Once we moved into Iraq, it was go, go, go for a long time. And it was very busy and there wasn't a lot of sleep and the Marines were tired out, but very motivated, very ready to do their jobs. Just did an incredible job out there. And then it got a little slower. We stayed in the south of Iraq. And as the war moved further north, I was at a refueling station for helicopters. And we sort of had less business as time went on. And it became a daily thing of making sure the Marines are keeping their eyes open and keeping on the ball and making sure that they're sort of staying focused and understanding why they're there and just you know, maintaining what we had put together for the first month or so.
Was it as hot and windy and sandy as it looked on television?
Probably more. It felt, and you'll hear this analogy probably a lot from folks who come back from there, but you would walk outside and it would feel like someone had plugged in a hairdryer, put it right in front of your face and was blowing it, and then took a handful of sand and threw it up in front of the hairdryer. It was miserable. I mean, especially the April, March, April, May timeframe over there is terrible sandstorms. Those guys are really going through a lot over there now. 135 degree temperatures, and just it's tough.
How do they train people to be able to withstand those kinds of major physical hardships?
The best thing we can do is make sure that the leaders know exactly what they're getting into and what to look for in their Marines to make sure they're taken care of, make sure they're drinking just tons and tons of water. I mean, everyone's wearing a camelback over there now. If they're not, they've got water close by. We drank bottled water there, so constantly had a bottle of water by your side. We have a training facility out in 29 Palms that in California, in the high desert of California, that has very similar climate, actually. And most Marines have been there 3-4 times, and that's at least some exposure to that type of weather. And then once you get out there, you watch for the signs of heat problems, and you just make sure the Marines are eating and drinking and putting their salt packets from their MREs into their food, and just kind of watch for those things.
You mentioned two terms I need clarity on. One is a camelback and MRE.
Camelback is the hydration pouch that you can wear on your back. They sell them in sports stores and stuff now, but the military has actually started issuing them to the young Marines at boot camp, and now they issue them out as part of their supply gear when they go overseas. They're wearing sort of a little backpack with about, I guess usually most of them, about 100 ounces of water. So you just fill that up and drink out of a tube that's coming from your back. And MREs are meals ready to eat. It's a meal in a pouch, as I'm sure you've seen on TV.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on young women serving in the military.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, an excellent book by authors Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Captain Mary Beth Brueggemann about young women serving in the military.
Can you elaborate a little bit more on what you do with the midshipmen that are under your watch? Are you in a classroom with them? Are you marching them around? Are you jogging with them? I have absolutely no idea what goes on.
It's a little bit of all of that, actually. They have a daily schedule, and it's rigorous, and it's very challenging for them. They wake up. I'm in a little bit before 7 in the morning, and they have a formation at 7 o'clock, and they all stand in the hall, and they make sure that everybody is there. They take accountability, and we have leaders in our companies called squad leaders, and they have 12 people under them. You know, everything that I do, I have only a couple of people that I need to go to. They go to a couple of people, and they go to a couple of people. Mm-hmm. Once it gets to the squad leaders, they have 12 midshipmen. Those are our small unit leaders, and they're the go-to guys. They're the ones that do all the real heavy lifting at the Naval Academy. They go to class, and at that point, there's usually meetings to go to. That's a great time for folks to get in a workout before, you know, when the midshipmen aren't there. And then they come back at about 11:45, and we do another formation. We all go down to lunch together. All the midshipmen go to lunch together and eat together in squads again. So those 12 people sit together there, and that's a chance for the squad leaders to develop their leadership skills and make sure they know what's going on with their people. And I just get backfilled on all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, eventually, you know, you always hear that you spend 90% of your time on 10% of your people. And that's what I spend 90% of my time doing, dealing with the 10%. The midshipmen need interference run for them, and that's why I have rank, and that's why I'm exactly where I am, and just making sure that I'm making it as easy as possible for them to develop their own leadership skills. They have parades that they march in, and I go out there with them, and that's a great chance for me to just see how they're doing and talk to them and make sure that they're doing well, and of course, critiquing their drill skills, their marching skills. So a little bit of everything.
What was it like going into Iraq?
We left actually in the mid-afternoon, and we had a convoy of about 30 vehicles. And
now, did you say this was the first day?
Actually, the first shots had been fired the middle of the night before. So we were into mid-afternoon, and we had actually watched as everything started the night before. We all sat up. We were about 5 kilometers south of the Iraqi border, so we could see everything. It was like a light show. I mean, as artillery landed and you could hear it and things happened, we watched that and woke up the next morning ready to go, completely ready to go. In fact, I don't even think we slept, and had to wait. As you probably saw on the news, there were so many thousands of vehicles trying to get across the border on March 21st, whatever day it was, that very first day, that there was a line. There were only so many paths you could take to get across the border, so there was a line. So we sort of found our place in line and got up there and crossed the border in the mid-afternoon and drove through into the night and arrived at about 10 o'clock at night at a small place, actually a small site in southern Iraq near Al-Nasiriya, which is probably the place that most folks will recognize.
Now, you weren't just by yourself in a Jeep, right?
I was in a Humvee, and I was one of four passengers.
But you were the head of how many?
I was the senior Marine of a little over 100 Marines. So we moved in, and our mission was to set up what's called a forward arming and refueling point in southern Iraq. We were the first FARP, as they're called, to set up in southern Iraq, and our purpose was to refuel helicopters and rearm them, make sure they had the missiles they needed and the rockets they needed and all that stuff. So we set up that night. It took us a couple of hours, and we had to make sure there was no unexploded ordnance where we were setting up, and got a couple hours of sleep, and then the next day was relatively quiet, and we worked out some of the kinks, and we had a couple helicopters land and refuel and sort of worked out some problems and moved things around. And then the next day is when 2nd Marines hit the very heavy and unexpected resistance in Al-Nasiriya and started taking casualties. And that's when we had attack helicopters in and out of our refueling point all day long. And it was just, the tempo was incredible. It was like nothing I've ever seen. We had 8 spots where helicopters could refuel. And at any given time, we had at least 12 helicopters around and coming in, and you know, the Marines didn't sleep or eat, I don't think, for 2 or 3 days. And it was a very interesting first week. There was no time to think about what had happened or what was going to happen. You just had to deal with what was happening right then. And it was fast, and it was extremely rewarding. I mean, it was just for the Marines, for me, for everybody, because we were putting fuel in attack helicopters that were flying to Al-Nasiriya, dealing with enemies that were trying to kill Marines. And it just, we felt so much like we were a part of the thing, and we were really doing our part in contributing. And it was, you know, as much as it can feel good in a situation like that, it was rewarding. At the end of the day, you sort of sighed and, you know, tried to catch a couple of hours of sleep if you could, and then just let it all process. Write it down if you had time. We kept encouraging people to write it down.
Was this the kind of thing where after this intensity for a few days, people were relieved so that other people who had actually slept would be able to do that job?
That would have been a great situation. Unfortunately, that wasn't really the case. We don't really have the manpower for that. So, you know, one of the things we do when we train is we train our Marines to make sure that they can function when they don't have a lot of sleep. When we do training exercises, we stay up very late in the night and we get up very early in the morning. So that training coupled with, you know, a little bit of adrenaline kept those guys going and kept them sharp. And they just reverted to everything that they knew. And they knew exactly how to do their jobs. If there was any question about that, it was gone within seconds. They were so confident, and they just, you know, they were on autopilot. It was quite fascinating to see, really.
And you had to oversee this whole operation. You were the officer in charge.
Exactly. And I was overseeing it. And that's, you know, that was great for me to be able to do that for my Marines, to be able to be there for them and watch them go through this and help them as much as I could. And there were little ways that I could help and making sure that folks weren't interfering with their operation and making sure that if we were getting low on fuel, that was something I had to deal with. And if someone, if the ordnance wasn't where it was supposed to be, that was something I had to deal with. And the Marines never knew. If I was doing my job right, the Marines never knew that the ordnance wasn't where it was supposed to be. They just knew that when they reached back to get a rocket, it was there. So that's what's, you know, so challenging and so great about about being a leader of Marines.
Do you feel that these young men will open up to somebody who's a young woman?
They do. I've always felt that I don't think my midshipmen have a problem approaching me or any woman. I mean, not me specifically, but there may be other reasons if they don't want to approach me. But no, they're surrounded by some strong women. They've always been surrounded by strong women and women who are very self-aware. I don't think that there's a very perceptible difference for them, to be honest. I mean, certainly if it was a very private issue, they might seek out a male, just as a female may seek me out over a male officer if it was a very private issue. But for the meat of the leadership stuff, I don't think that that's something they really think about too much.
What contributions do you think women bring to a military environment that would be different than men would bring?
I went to the Naval Academy and graduated in 99, and, you know, I saw one thing from the women there, and I think I've seen one thing from me, you know, characteristics I bring to the military. But I look around me now at the young people I'm surrounded by now that are our future leaders, and I'm in awe. I mean, they are strong, they are so capable, they're athletic, they're intelligent, some of them are brilliant, and they're just, you know, incredible, wonderful, just confident women around me everywhere, and it's impressive. And every one of them that the men around me see brings women just a little bit closer to equality in every way in the military, in numbers, in everything that we do. And I think that I'm so impressed with them. I'm proud of them, and I'm proud to be associated with them at all. I'm glad that they're going to be in the service representing me, because they're impressive.
We're talking to all kinds of people in this discussion, because we have parents, grandparents, but we have doctors, lawyers, social workers, and psychiatrists and psychologists, and all kinds of school personnel. Everybody's listening from different angles. I think all would be interested in whether you would recommend, from your own experiences, to most young women, the military as a career choice.
Absolutely. No hesitation on that one. I have had a chance to learn so much about myself and about my limitations and my capabilities, especially the things I can do that I had no idea I could ever do, the ways I can push myself that I just would never have known, I don't think.
Can you give an example of that?
This may be good or bad for the parents out there, but for the young women out there, I'll speak to them. You know, graduating from college, I left out of there, and within a year, I had 40 individuals, 40 young men who I was directly responsible for. And that was, you know, that they lived under my terms, and they, you know, I was responsible for their financial responsibility, their physical development, for their training, for everything to do with their lives. It fell under me, and I was 22 years old. I was a fresh second lieutenant. I was 22. And you learn so much about yourself in that situation. And I had wonderful senior enlisted, you know, gunnery sergeants and master sergeants and staff sergeants who walked me through every step of it and taught me how to figure out what kind of leader I wanted to be and just become, you know, so much more myself than I thought I could be, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's interesting, because you're talking about sergeants dealing with a lieutenant. And you've got people who are more experienced than you dealing with somebody who was basically outranking them.
Yep.
How was that dynamic?
That's challenging. It's really challenging. And that's one thing that makes people very nervous when they go out to the fleet, to the Marine Forces. After doing training for so long, you report to your first unit. It's a brand new second lieutenant. And, you know, it's even worse because you're wearing a uniform that you only wear when you report into a unit. So everyone knows that you're the new guy.
Oh, and, dear.
And it's a tough day to go through. It's a tough couple months to go through. But those guys are trained. I had staff sergeants whose job it was to train me. And they took that very seriously. And they're very professional about it. And they recognize fully that I have things that I bring to the table that they don't have and that they need and that they want as part of their skill set in their platoon. And, you know, a college education is a big part of it. That's why our officers have to have a college education or be meritoriously commissioned from the enlisted ranks. That's important. I brought to the table something that those guys were looking for, something they needed, the, you know, the rank and the ability to deal with folks that they had absolutely no desire to deal with. They wanted to do their jobs. That was their thing. They wanted to, I was a construction platoon commander, and they just wanted to do their construction projects, not have any interference. And that was my function in life, was to make sure they had the supplies they needed and they had everything there when they needed it to be there. And if anybody from higher up came in, and it was my job to step in and just make sure that I'm handling the bureaucracy part of it while they handle the meat of it and the training and the doing.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on young women serving in the military.
For an audio cassette copy of Any Parent's Perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Captain Mary Beth Brueggemann about young women serving in the military. To me, it seems overwhelming to take someone who's just graduated from college and give that person so much responsibility.
It's a big leap of faith, I think. But, you know, we train our young officers extremely well. 4 years at the Naval Academy, you're ready. And that's the big message we have for our young folks there that are We really hound into them, hey, you're going into combat. You're going. It's out there now. This is the world you're living in the military. This is what you signed up for. And post September 11th, I'm telling you, you're going to see combat. I promise you. And it makes them very nervous. And they say, oh, am I ready? What am I going to do? And the biggest thing we can tell them is you are ready. We trained you well. You are smart, focused, driven people who are going to graduate from here and are just going to do great things. And you have to trust that. You have to trust in your training. It's like rock climbing. You have to trust in your shoes. Mm-hmm. It's a big step.
I'm thinking of the first Gulf War versus the second Gulf War. Do you think that there's a difference in what people come in expecting, young people? Because the first Gulf War was almost like a great big video game, and the second Gulf War has been very different.
Yeah, I think that we really live in a different world than we did back in 91. That war was finite. This mm-hmm. one is not. And there are no illusions about that in the military or, you know, amongst our young people that are joining up. I think we make it very clear to them that you're entering into a world where we have a very specific mission now. We are combating terrorism. There are not people that we can pinpoint to do that. I wish that there were. We would line them all up and it would be very easy. But there aren't. It's not that simple. And it is going to take a very long time and a lot of dedication and a lot of patience. And our folks know that, and if they're joining, they're aware of that. And if they're staying in, that they're aware of the challenges that are going to be facing them and their families and everyone around them.
What kind of skill sets, if you were counseling a high school student, for example, who's thinking about this or not thinking about this, or a parent who's going, what kinds of skill sets or personality types would you say, yeah, that's probably a decent fit?
Well, we're definitely looking for very strong people. We're looking for people who know themselves or are at least well on the way. We're looking for people with honor and with integrity and folks who are really willing to suck up everything around them and just learn and do their best. The young men and women that I'm with every day at the Naval Academy are competitive and they're strong and they're self-aware and they're independent and they're just wanting to learn everything around them and be leaders and be part of a sense of service that I think people really do benefit from. So that's the biggest thing I would say is, you know, just folks who seem to fit into that mold, and even the ones that don't but can grow. That's exactly what we're looking for. That's where we want them to be at the end of the training, not necessarily at the beginning.
Okay. Any words of comfort you might want to say to parents whose kids are thinking of doing this?
It sounds scary, and I know that my mom and dad were both very, very nervous people, especially when I was deployed. And I know that that's very tough, but, you know, we need strong men and women right now who are going to do this. And especially for myself, I love what I'm doing. I love it. And I wouldn't be the person that I am if I hadn't done exactly this. And so I suppose I would tell parents that if this is something that your children are thinking about, try to support them if you can, because those are the folks we're really looking for, and it's an incredible accomplishment, I think, for these guys to come out and to serve and to feel like they're serving their country and to really be part of something.
What kinds of resources would you suggest for our listeners who want to learn more about young women in the military?
There's a lot. Actually, the Naval Academy admissions site, which is at www.usna.edu, there's an admissions link on there. They have specific sites and links for the women's perspective at the Naval Academy and a diversity profile at the Naval Academy. And there are words from young women who have just graduated from the Naval Academy and some older graduates about what their experience was like. There's plenty of women out there. There's plenty of resources out there to talk to, folks who have been through this and who have made it through it. That's a great website. Of course, I've got to plug the www.usmc.mil. The Marine Corps website has the same type of resources, and there's great information on there for anyone who wants to join up and find out exactly what we're all about.
There are many ways to get in the military, right? You don't necessarily have to graduate from a service academy.
Absolutely. The Naval Academy is one way. Any college graduate can go through a commissioning program. It's a 6 or 10 week program in Quantico. It's called Officer Candidate School. That's one way to do it as college graduates. And of course, folks that aren't going to college or have gone to college but decide they want to enlist and not be an officer and go that different route can find their nearest recruiting station. And their recruiter, I promise you, will take it from there.
Well, you have taken us a long way and given us an awful lot of wonderful information, and I hope calmed down some parents as well. So, Captain Mary Beth Brueggemann, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our book, Washington, D.C. with Kids. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address and mention show 232. Tell us if you can what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning into. Washington, D.C. with Kids is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents' Perspective and our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. At the end of our program, we often thank individuals or foundations for their generous donations that help with the cost of producing Parents' Perspective programs. Parents' Perspective is a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. Today, it is our turn to thank you, our listeners, for your tax-deductible contributions to our annual fundraising campaign. Please send your checks or money orders to Parents' Perspective Incorporated, Post Office Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015. Again, that's Parents' Perspective Incorporated, Post Office Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015. Thank you for helping us to continue to work for you. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.